Thank you, Lee. And now we'll hear from Morton Blackwell.
Thank you, Ken. It's almost impossible for people who grew up in the Goldwater for President effort to be objective now about Senator Goldwater. We can't help loving him, no matter what he might do. We know he paid his lifetime dues more than 30 years ago. Judging the long political career of Barry Goldwater, as most politicians are judged, one might say he was a failure. His 1964 presidential campaigns set records for losing. Every traditional Republican state was swept by President Lyndon Johnson, whose popular vote victory margin was almost 16 million votes. Republicans lost a staggering 37 seats in the House of Representatives and two in the Senate. The next year, my friend Tom Paukin, then college Republican national chairman and now state chairman of the Republican Party of Texas, told me the term conservative was so badly discredited that we would have to think of some other word to describe our pro-freedom political philosophy. Senator Goldwater's legislative record, measured by usual standards, didn't look much better. Rarely did he propose major bills or amendments which passed. Rarely did his opposition prevent major bills or amendments from passing. Yet Barry Goldwater was an essential man for American conservatives. If America shakes off any of the increasingly heavy shackles of big government, it will be because of what Senator Goldwater did. The presidential election landslides of the 1980s, the many special and off-year elections during the 2 years after the 1992 defeat of President George Bush, and the sweeping Republican landslide victory in November 1994 were all made possible by the earlier efforts of Barry Goldwater. Not that he intended these specific political results. What Adam Smith called an invisible hand can work in a free political system as well as in a free economic system. The new normal governing majority in American politics is composed of economic issue conservatives and social issue conservatives. That was no part of Goldwater's intention, certainly not after his 1964 defeat. Barry Goldwater campaigned for political power to implement his conservative philosophy. In that, he was unsuccessful. But he was a highly successful communicator of ideas who challenged the reigning political orthodoxy and created a base of activists who went on to build our country's new normal governing majority. Those who cannot remember Goldwater in his prime, before his 1964 defeat, can have little idea of how powerfully he expressed pro-freedom ideas. He was never given his due by the dominant news and opinion media. They did all they could to belittle and marginalize him. There have been few subsequent books, none of them of wide circulation, which would reveal even to serious students the significance of Barry Goldwater. That is why Dr. Lee Edwards' new book, Goldwater, will be so valuable. The book's carefully worded subtitle, The Man Who Made a Revolution, states its theme. Goldwater did not win the conservative revolution, but he made it. He created it. Principled, articulate, handsome, tireless. In the later 1950s and early 1960s, he was an exciting personality. He spoke out for the historic ideas of America, limited government, free enterprise, strong national defense, and yes, traditional moral values. Goldwater's ringing proclamations struck responsive chords where these ideas were still cherished in the hearts of millions of Americans who had never accepted Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal or its lineal descendants. Lee Edwards captures the authentic Goldwater for posterity. Goldwater fearlessly spoke truths, truths about the dangers of big government, truths about the nature of communism, and yes, truths about our culture. He spoke truths which those on the American political left hoped had been buried and eliminated forever from political discourse. As he vigorously spoke out for endangered conservative principles, Goldwater was David against Goliath. He was Horatio at the bridge. He was Leonidas at Thermopylae. He was the honest boy who shouted that the emperor had no clothes. No wonder he became the hero of so many Americans. For those who agreed with him, Barry Goldwater had charisma with a capital C. His pure message was unadulterated with the opportunism so commonly found in politicians. He said exactly what he thought, with almost no discernible concern about the political consequences. Long before his presidential campaign adopted its slogan, "In our hearts, conservatives knew he was right." Self-educated, he never pretended to be an intellectual. But for conservatives, there was no question of our intellectual respectability. Goldwater and those Americans who looked to him as our political spokesman had a solid foundation of intellectual support. Milton Friedman, Russell Kirk, F.A. Hayek, William F. Buckley Jr., William A. Rusher, Frank Meyer, and dozens of other exceptionally bright people were during these years thinking, writing, teaching, and speaking at the height of their powers. Most of them worked diligently and effectively to make converts to their views. A conservative student admirer of Senator Goldwater might not be able to argue toe-to-toe with his local leftist professor, but that student had access to brilliant, inspiring books, articles, columns, and speeches by conservative intellectuals whom he knew could debate circles around the most clever liberal academician. Confident that they were in the right, in the sense of being correct, conservative students, intellectuals, and just plain citizens jumped on the Goldwater bandwagon, many becoming political activists for the first time in their lives. For a new political phenomenon, the conservative movement made remarkable strides. Before the 1963 assassination of President Kennedy, Goldwater was doing much better in the polls against Jack Kennedy than he ever did against Lyndon Johnson. Even facing an almost certainly hopeless race against President Johnson, the Goldwater forces soundly defeated the long-dominant Republican liberal Eastern establishment in contests for delegates to the 1964 Republican National Convention and captured about half of the state parties. The crushing defeat of Goldwater in November 1964 demoralized many Goldwater activists. Some dropped out of politics. Many of us, however, had enjoyed the taste of success in our intra-party battles. We concluded that victory in 1964 had not been possible, that Lyndon Johnson's victory was not conservatives' fault, that our cause was ultimately winnable, and that our political prospects depended on our own future actions. We remained active and built on our experience. The Republican Party's youth organizations stayed in explicitly Goldwaterite hands for more than a decade, recruiting a new generation of like mind. Eventually, many of us became organizational entrepreneurs, building political action committees, lobbies, and foundations, which multiplied the number and effectiveness of conservative activists. Others became scholars, congressional staff, or senior Republican Party leaders. All this is recounted in interesting detail in Lee Edwards' book. Proof of participation in the Goldwater campaign became a badge of honor, sometimes a lifelong credential for many of us. In a political world teeming with opportunists, the battle for Goldwater was like Shakespeare's account of Agincourt. We happy few became a band of brothers. All this Goldwater made possible and more. In 1965, a young man named Richard A. Viguerie showed up at the General Accounting Office in Washington, D.C., and began to copy out from government records the names and addresses of donors who had contributed $50 or more to the Goldwater for President Committee. That was legal in those days. Soon his hands tired, so he hired Kelly girls to come in and copy more of the names. Before the General Accounting Office staff threw them out, Viguerie had a list of 12,500 Goldwater donors. With that list, Viguerie built a new industry. At that time, the donor lists of none of the existing conservative organizations was available for use or rental by others. At first, Viguerie's list was the only one on the market. The stunning new technology of direct mail in the public policy process, soon learned by many others, enabled conservatives to fund a staggering variety of independent organizations and election campaigns, to communicate personally with mass numbers of voters, and to lobby effectively for conservative causes. Conservative movement direct mail broke the back of the left-wing communications monopoly in America, and it began with the list of 1964 Goldwater donors. After 1964, the conservative movement gradually went on the offensive. Barry Goldwater went on the defensive. Before 1964, Goldwater was everywhere available to help conservative candidates and organizations. After 1964, at best, Goldwater was like a defender under siege at his post on a wall. From time to time, he'd take a shot at some barbarian who rode by, but his days of advancing the conservative cause were over. He made news primarily on those occasions when he took pot shots at fellow conservatives. Rather abruptly, he underwent a transformation from an inspiring hero to an endearing curmudgeon. An anecdote. Congressman Sam Steiger of Arizona, cut from much the same cloth as Barry Goldwater, asked his old friend Barry to sign a fundraising letter for his 1974 reelection campaign. Goldwater agreed. Steiger asked Richard Viguerie to handle the mailing. Working for Viguerie at the time, I was assigned the job of drafting the letter and overseeing the production of the mailing, which we hoped would raise $40,000. There was no way the Viguerie Company could make much money from such a mailing. Viguerie undertook the mailing as a favor to Congressman Steiger. Drafting the letter, I poured myself into Barry Goldwater's persona. I tried to write a letter Barry might have personally written to an old friend from the 1964 campaign. Between 1958 and 1964, I had read every scrap I could find about and by Goldwater and taken every opportunity to see and hear him in person. My autographed copy of Conscience of a Conservative was dated October 1960. I had been on the original 11-member steering committee of National Youth for Goldwater, as well as his youngest delegate to the 1964 Republican National Convention. So I was happy to try my hand at writing a letter for his signature. Senator Goldwater approved my draft letter. We mailed it to a list, including the surviving Goldwater donors from a decade earlier, which we thought large enough to raise the $40,000 Congressman Steiger wanted. Far surpassing our expectations, the letter netted the Steiger campaign a total of $160,000. Viguerie had charged the Steiger campaign on a per-letter mailed basis. He would have been paid the same if the letter had netted only the expected amount or even less. But when Senator Goldwater learned how much had been raised, he angrily concluded the direct mail company had made an outrageous profit. To this day, he still believes that. And from that day, he virtually stopped signing letters for conservative organizations or for individual conservative candidates. Intransigent, as always, he would not listen to the facts of the matter. His signature on that letter to that list simply did much better for his friend Sam Steiger than could reasonably have been expected. Goldwater was clearly uncomfortable with the growth of the conservative movement after he stopped being its standard bearer. Frank Meyer, senior editor of National Review, had persuaded most movement conservatives well before 1964 that our future success lay in the fusion of economic conservatives and traditional values conservatives. Before his defeat, Senator Goldwater acted as if he concurred. Later, he resented the new and essentially defensive activism of social issue conservatives who were outraged at attacks on their values. The federal courts, previously a target of Barry Goldwater's frequent criticism, overturned settled laws and social policy in every jurisdiction in America. To be fair, it must be admitted that Goldwater probably had never been asked in 1964 his position on legalizing abortion. It was illegal everywhere, like bank robbery. Undoubtedly, Barry Goldwater also resented Ronald Reagan, as Lee Edwards' excellent new book amply documents. Reagan was an even better communicator. Reagan knew how to say unpleasant things pleasantly. Reagan shared Goldwater's conservative principles, but unlike Goldwater, Reagan obviously cared what others thought of him. Most aggravating of all, Ronald Reagan was successful where Goldwater had failed. Like Moses, Barry Goldwater was not destined to lead his people into the promised land. Unfortunately, also like Moses, Barry was unhappy about that fate. But we must always be grateful for what he did for us and for America.